Good morning. I'm ready to read another piece of this book called The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Blockbauer by Anne Marie O'Connor. And today's chapter heading is called Thunder at Twilight. I'm making a coffee here in the background so I can have a little coffee this morning. Thunder at Twilight, here we go. There were many things Maria had not told Fritz. At the Stubenbastei, Gustav had declined precipitously after the Gestapo stole his Stradivarius and suicide took his best friend. Did that make sense? At the Stubenstei, Gustav had declined precipitously after the Gestapo stole his Stradivarius and suicide took his best friend. Okay. It was as if all the losses of old age had happened overnight. One day, Teresa asked George, the butler, to go to the butcher. George gave her a hard look. Things will be different now, George said, and walked off the job. Emma was ill, so Teresa ventured out, looking away from the swastikas hanging from the stores. The one day she asked the baker for Gustav's favorite pumpkin seed rolls, but the shopkeeper only glared. The Gestapo had arrested Maria's brother Leopold as a hostage for the assets of his father-in-law. Leopold had managed to flee abroad with a promise of shares of the sugar factory, which Ferdinand had protected in a Swiss bank trust. The sudden deaths continued. An entire family committed suicide with weapons the sons had once proudly displayed with their World War I medals. Gustav begged Teresa not to go out again, even for a walk. He was afraid his indomitable wife would never come back. "Where's Fritzl?" Gustav kept asking. Maria told her father Fritz was still in prison. She didn't dare tell him Fritz was now in Dachau. Gustav now had severe gastrointestinal pain, which couldn't be blamed on nerves. He had suddenly worsened. Teresa told Maria her father had cancer and that it had metastasized. They searched for a specialist willing to treat him. Gentile doctors were reluctant or unwilling to treat Jews, and Jewish doctors were on the run or in hiding. The Felsovanius Sanatorium, Low, the top private medical center, had been ironized. Teresa heard it was to be the Vienna headquarters for the German Luftwaffe. On July 2nd, Teresa looked in on Gustav and realized with a shock that he was gone. It was inconceivable to hold a service at the Stadt Temple, 2 blocks from Gestapo headquarters at the Hotel Metropole. Instead, they quietly placed Gustav's ashes in an urn at the family mausoleum in Central Cemetery, under the gold-lettered plaque of Adele Blockbauer. Hans Mühlbacher played for the funeral service with the two other members of Gustav's quartet. They played Mozart, whose joyous spirit seemed to conjure up the merry Gustav of the old days. Gustav Reinsch dropped in to check on Maria. Reinsch was pulling any strings he could on Fritz's behalf, and now his drinking buddies came in handy. One of the Richthofen barons a nephew of World War I, flying ace Manfred von Richthofen, the Red Baron, was overseeing Aryanized Jewish banks. Reinsch told Richthofen's staff that getting Fritz out of Dachau alive, I guess it's Dachau, remember that, Fritz out of Dachau alive would persuade Bernard to hand over all his foreign accounts. Reinsch poured Maria some whiskey, but he did most of the drinking. He told Maria he was worried about her. "I don't think you ever knew how much in love with you I was," Reinsch began after a couple of drinks, his eyes bleary as if he hadn't been sleeping well. There was a long, awkward silence. I'm going to take a drink. Maria dreamed of Fritz, dreams where he kissed her again and again as he had in Paris, or dreams where Fritz was again the aloof stranger who loved someone else, and Maria would wake feeling haunted and unloved, relieved to remember that Fritz hadn't abandoned her. They had taken him away. A few weeks after her father died, Maria awoke so loud. Too loud knocking. It was early. Maria pulled on a dress and drowsily opened the door to stony-faced Gestapo officers. Maria froze. Arrest was commonplace now. The men parted to reveal a gaunt, sunburnt man, his head fuzzy with short stubble. Fritz! A fragile-looking Fritz who bore no resemblance to the suave dandy who had won her heart with a romantic ode. But he was alive. Fritz smiled wanly as the Gestapo officers took their leave. Inside the door, he clung to her. Now Fritz and Maria enjoyed a second honeymoon, conducted in hushed whispers. Fritz was frightened, worried by the guards in the openly hostile world outside. He became feverish, and for days he slept. He awoke ravenously hungry and asked for Viennese pastries with whipped cream. "I'm in love with my husband," Maria typed on a sheet of paper, one hot afternoon in September as Fritz slept. "Night and day, you are the one, only you beneath the moon and under the sun. In the roaring traffic, in the loneliness of my lonely room, I think of you." Reinsch joked that Dachau had turned his rival Fritz into a crew-cut skull, which didn't improve his looks. In the heat of late August, Reinsch spent his days in line at the Palais Albert Rothschild. It was now the new central office for Jewish emigration, presided over by Adolf Eichmann. Reinsch said the mansion had been picked clean of art, furniture, fixtures, everything. The Nazis told Reinsch they wanted Maria's mother, Teresa, to sign over. The Nazis told Reinsch they wanted Maria's mother, Teresa, to sign over any remaining family valuables, too. One day, as Reinsch stood in line to get Maria's brother Robert a passport, Gestapo agents came by to kick, insult, and spit on Jews in line. "You don't look like a Jew," a young Gestapo agent remarked to Reinsch. "I'm here for a friend who's sick in bed," Reinsch replied. Robert was sick with fear. "You Jew lackey," the agent said derisively, laughing at Reinsch. After a lifetime in Vienna, known for its social delicacy, Reinsch was appalled. Fritz's family was observant. They had welcomed the Sabbath together every Friday evening with silver candlesticks that were such treasured keepsakes that their father had buried them when the emperor called for donations of metal in World War I. As roving gangs beat Jews on the streets in Vienna, Maria decided to please Fritz with a special celebration of the Jewish holiday Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. Maria was a novice cook. Her dish, Fräulein Emma's Hungarian-style peppers, stuffed with spicy meats, was not entirely appropriate. Maria nervously pulled the hot dish from the oven. The peppers spilled all over the floor. She looked up with chagrin. But for the first time since his return, Fritz met her eyes and smiled with conspiratorial amusement, like the old Fritz. After helping her pick the peppers off the floor, he sat down with her and ate them, proclaiming the dish a delectable triumph. Bernard finally got them a message. "I have found a way for you to leave. You must do exactly what I say and tell no one. Wait until you hear from me." All Saints' Day was approaching. Roving mobs of brown shirts were erupting into spontaneous riots, randomly arresting Jews in the street. "Why are we still here?" Maria thought desperately one day as she walked past Adele Fernandad's house on Elisabethstrasse, now dark and shuttered, on her way to the Stubenbastei. Jochen answered the door at her house, wagging his tail and spinning happily. Silly Jochen! What would become of him? Maria had heard the Nazis shot the dogs of Jewish families right in front of them. It was very quiet. Emma was sleeping, though it was early afternoon. Emma was very ill. As Teresa set the table for lunch, Maria tiptoed into Emma's room and sat on her bed. Emma, her dear nanny, finally opened her eyes. "Emma," Maria whispered, "Fritz and I are going to escape. We'll take you with us." The gray-haired Emma was no longer a young Fräulein. Maria was like a daughter to her. Emma smiled, imagining an adventure, a life together far away. "I love you more than life," Emma said. "I can't come. I'm too sick." Doctors suspected she had ovarian cancer. Soon Emma would go back to her village. Maria asked Emma to give Jochen to George. George loved Jochen. Maria hugged Emma. As she left, Emma called out that the jeweler needed to see her. The jeweler greeted Maria gravely and locked the door. His face was old and lined. He was sober and unsmiling, but now they must have picked his... By now, they must have picked his safe clean. Turning in Jewish jewelry was mandatory. The jeweler opened a small purple flannel bag and revealed two diamond earrings that matched Adele's necklace. He pressed the bag into Maria's hand. "I saved these for you, Maria. They could help you." Meaning, Maria supposed, that they could be used as a bribe. The jeweler attempted a strained smile. "Go with God, Maria." Maria asked Landau for permission to leave the house with Fritz for a doctor's appointment. They took a city train, getting off at different stations to see if anyone was following. No one seemed to be. Another day, Maria told the guard they were going to the dentist. Listening to the radio, the guard disinterestedly told them to return by 5 that evening. It was a cloudy fall morning. Maria and Fritz pulled on their raincoats and set off. They walked a few blocks, hailed a cab, and asked to go to the airport. Maria had Adele's diamond earrings in her brassiere. At the airport, a bespectacled man with cold expression inspected their tickets carefully. A Catholic woman Maria knew had purchased tickets for a small commercial flight to the German city of Cologne. Since Austria was now Germany, they didn't need passports. Fritz had no papers. The man waved them to the gate, and Maria breathed a sigh of relief. When they boarded the plane, a pretty blonde attendant looked Maria over carefully. Maria and Fritz went to the back of the plane and took the last seats. There were only 10 other passengers. The plane's propellers whirred, and Maria and Fritz relaxed. Then the propellers spun to a stop. The stairs returned to the plane, and the door of the plane opened. The captain came out of the cockpit, and he looked back at Maria and Fritz. Maria squeezed Fritz's hand. She was terrified. The Gestapo must have learned of Fritz's absence. They would be arrested. Some officials boarded and spoke with the flight crew, who nodded gravely. The pretty attendant asked for their attention. Bad weather at their destination had caused a delay. She thanked the passengers for their patience. Then she approached Maria and Fritz. They froze. "I was admiring your raincoat," the attendant said to Maria in a German accent, smiling. "Did you get it in Vienna?" 40 minutes later, the plane took off for Cologne. When they landed, they went to the Gothic Cathedral of Cologne to meet the contact who would take them to the Dutch border. They waited nervously for the rest of the afternoon. The man didn't come. "Let's not waste any more time," Fritz said. They boarded a train to the German city of Aachen. There they gave a cab driver an address in Kolzschied, a small German town on the border. The driver couldn't find the house. Finally, he turned down a one-way street that led to the border post where Germans stood guard. "Let's ask them," the cab driver said. "Oh, God, no," Maria thought. Maria asked the cab driver to drop them off. She and Fritz walked briskly, unsure of where they were going, when Maria suddenly saw a striking, handsome young priest. "Ah, yes, a lot of my people go to him," the priest said when they showed him the address. "I'll take you." The priest stopped at the house of a farmer, Jan Servetius Honf. Honf was a tall, long-limbed man with high cheekbones, clear blue eyes, and a kind, reassuring smile. He was Dutch and the father of 6 children. His farmland ran along the German side of the border. The border had always been friendly and porous until the Nazi takeover. Jan's son, Josef, worked in a mine a few miles away in Holland, so the family often crossed back and forth every day. Jan had expected Maria and Fritz to arrive the next day, but he welcomed them into his home. They sat down to a farmer's dinner of chicken and bread with thick slabs of white cheese washed down with lager. They waited for the change in shifts at the border post they had passed, which would allow several-minute lull in vigilance. Josef was to be their guide. He was in his early 20s and recently married with a little girl, Ilfried, who devoted on her father. But Josef had expected them to come the following day, and he wasn't there. So Jan walked them into the crisp fall night. The sky was dark with stars and a sliver of a moon. Maria had her diamond earrings in her bra. She and Fritz followed Jan through his pasture and over the stepping stones of a little brook. Jan stopped for a moment and looked at the guards. Then he gingerly held the barbed wire and whispered, "Hop," to Maria. Maria didn't see the wire in the dark, and she thought he said run. So she charged blindly ahead, falling face forward over the barbed wire into the mud, shredding her silk stockings. She lay there, certain she had given them all away. Fritz stepped carefully over the wire and helped Maria up. Jan waved goodbye and melted into the night. A Dutch man and woman stepped from the shadows, putting their fingers to their lips. "We'll do the talking," the woman whispered. But they met no Dutch border patrol on their walk to their little hotel in Maastricht. Bernard had made arrangements with the son-in-law of the chief of police, and the hotel barred the doors behind them. At dawn, Maria and Fritz ran to catch the train to Amsterdam. In the Dutch capital, Bernard had a private plane waiting with champagne and caviar. At Liverpool, Bernard's contact in immigration welcomed them warmly, though Fritz had no papers. Bernard already had a factory in Liverpool. Maria and Fritz stared at each other. It was unreal. They had made it. Back in Vienna, the Gestapo banged on Teresa's door. "Where are your children?" they demanded. Teresa had no idea when they were talking what they were talking about. The Gestapo returned the next day. "We know your children are in Yugoslavia, and we can find them there," they said. "Luis, but Yugoslavia was unoccupied. Were the Nazis already covering the Gutmann Timber Empire?" "My children are in England," Teresa said evenly. The Gestapo was furious. Bernard Altman had managed to get their prime hostage to his fortune out of the country. Bernard's wife, mistress, his children, and even many of his friends and factory workers had quietly escaped abroad with the help of his cash and connections. The Nazis had his Vienna factory, his homes, his furniture, and art, but Bernard had outmaneuvered them. He already had a competing factory in Liverpool. Maria and Fritz were among the last to make it out on this lifeline. The operation was an open secret, and the Germans soon learned who was running it. They arrested Jan Olf and deported him to Poland, to a concentration camp outside of Lodz. Jan's six children fled to unoccupied Holland, but when the Nazis invaded Holland in May 1940, Jan's son Josef was packed off to Auschwitz. Jan survived the war. Josef didn't make it through the first winter. He died in February 1941 at Auschwitz, where the people he and his father led to freedom were supposed to die, a friend of his wrote to Maria. Josef's daughter, Elfried, never recovered from the loss of her father. Years later, she cried when survivors wrote to thank the Ulm family for saving their lives. And that is the last part of that chapter. Next, we will read about decent, honorable people. Thanks for listening, and we move forward in this story that seems pretty heavy at the middle of it. Well, we're not quite in the... Yeah, I guess we are about halfway through. About page 135. Thanks for listening.